What's going on, everybody? Welcome into the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast. I am your guest host for the week, Joe Orico, and I am joined today by a very special guest. I guess we are both technically guests today, but Kevin Hasting, my good longtime friend within the industry and fellow FTN colleague. We're going to talk about what he does at FTN in just a second, but Kev, great to get behind the mic with you. We're filling in for Vlad on his well-needed vacation this week, but it gives us a chance to catch up, and I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah, absolutely, Joey. It's great to see you. It has been too long, although we did we did get together not too long ago, but for a brief little podcast. But here we are to talk some baseball. Always love talking baseball with you, Joe.
It's always a lot of fun, my friend. We're both FTN members. I do the Thursday night, Friday morning waiver wire article. Adam Young did cover me for a couple of those recently as I had just a lot going on. So he did fill in for me, but you will see me writing those regularly on Fridays going forward. Kev, what is it that you are doing at FTN? Let the people know who might not be familiar, because I think everybody knows your fantastic work with Adam Howe at PitcherList on the On the Wire podcast. But let us know what you got going on at FTN.
Yeah, I help Vlad out with the daily lineups for the upcoming week. Therefore, then the algorithm can run the projections based on hopefully a more accurate projection of plate appearances and at least handedness of pitcher that those plate appearances will be against, if not specific pitcher. So it is a little time consuming, and Vlad and I start getting together. It's something we can't do too early with the pitching matchups for the following week. So we start getting it together on typically Friday afternoon, Friday evening to finish those up by Saturday evening so he can get them all ran. So we have those weekly projections ready to go before Fab on Sunday.
It is a labor of love, but it's a necessary one. Those projections are essential every week before I'm setting my lineups and even setting fab bids, just taking a look at what the projections are calling for the week ahead. And it also helps me as well when writing my waiver wire articles, just to see, all right, this guy, player A, may have a slight edge over player B, especially in those 12-team lineups. I mean, in 15s, a lot of the time, I'm just looking for a warm body. But in 12s, there are a lot of really hard lineup decisions. And make sure you guys are checking out the projections and the fab tools. There's so much stuff here at FTN to help you guys out in your weekly decisions.
It's today, a huge advantage to me as a player, because it's something that I should be doing anyway. And I think we all do to an extent, but it's one of those things I don't think very many of us go as deep as we'd like to. And it forces me to do that. So yeah, it's a big advantage to myself as well.
Yeah, that's something that I think gets lost sometimes, is that the work within the industry really does help us to be better players. If you're writing an article about a specific topic week in and week out, you're naturally going to be a little bit better with that topic. I've had to write up a lot of stuff about middle infielders over the last couple of years at FanGraphs and for the Fantasy Black Book. I've covered second base and shortstop write-ups, and I feel like I'm a little bit more prepared in those positions naturally.
Because like Bubba and his catchers.
Like Bubba with catchers, like Greg Jewett with relievers. Like there are certain people who have those niches. Not that I'm the second base guy, but if you are looking at specific topics on a regular basis, it will give you a bit of a leg up in that regard. But today, we're going to have a little bit of fun. We're going to talk about a few topics that I would say are the biggest storylines to this point of the fantasy baseball season. And it's really hard to believe, like I said to Kev before we started recording, that we are about a third of the way through the season, even a little bit more. I think technically it's like 37, 38% of the way through the year. And there are a couple of storylines that have really caught my eye. And this is maybe not the biggest one, but for me, I think it's the one that stands out the most. And it's just how amazing catchers have been as a whole to this point of the season, Kev. There are 9 catchers that are inside of the top 50 overall players on the FanGraphs player rater to this point of the season. The names that are carrying the heavy load are Ben Rice at the very top of the player rater, a $42 player to this point, number one with a bullet. Drake Baldwin is still the number 5 overall player, despite being out the last couple weeks, with a $34 valuation. Liam Hicks, out of absolutely nowhere, is the number 10 overall player. And he was leading the league in RBI for a long period of time. I think he might be second or third now, but just an incredible undrafted season out of Liam Hicks. And then Shea Langeliers no slouch in his own right, 12th among all catchers with a $29 valuation. I know that this has generally been something we've seen over the last couple of years, that the catcher pool has gotten a slowly but surely stronger, Kev. Is this a trend that you expect to continue throughout the rest of the season? Are we going to end up with three or four catchers finishing as first-round values? And how do you think this will impact people drafting for next season? Because it's rather taboo to take a catcher in the first round. Even after Cal Raleigh's maybe the best season we've ever seen from a catcher, he still wasn't really going consistently in the first round. So what do you make of what we've seen from catchers to this point, and how do you think that'll impact us going forward?
Yeah, I think it's really intriguing. And then when you look at that play, same Fangraphs player rater over the last 30 days, which is about half of what we have seen so far from these players, number one is Kybert Ruiz, who for right. So there's even more of these guys that when they're coming back from injury and getting back in the lineups have really been amazing as well. I think some of it does have to do with, especially these younger guys, it does have to do with ABS. I think that at the development of these teams, they're concentrating on catchers that can hit. Now, you only get two incorrect challenges per game, so it's not a 100% thing, but I think it does have some influence. There still is value to framing with only the two incorrect challenges per game, and then you're done. But I think that does influence a little bit, especially with these younger guys. So in that aspect, it will continue to some extent, I believe.
When you're looking at the top of the catchers, and maybe not necessarily just the guys that I mentioned, those top four, but even the Hunter Goodmans, the William Contreras, Dylan Dingler is having an amazing season. He had the two homers the other night after he had been a little bit slow for the last couple of weeks, but did have the two homer game. Yvonne Herrera, Ryan Jeffers, who's unfortunately gotten injured but was amazing before. Are people going to start to, by and large, start paying a little bit more for catchers, you think? Because you are getting that out of position plate appearance boost that normally you don't get, especially from the top guys. You're getting 400-ish plate appearances, nothing that is really, you know, jumping out too much. But from those top guys, especially, you know, the Ben Rices, the guys that are playing a lot of DH, guys that are playing first base, I think that we're going to start to see catchers by and large become a very expensive commodity over the next couple of years, partly because of the talent, but partly also just because of what we've seen from these names. Is that crazy to think, Kev, that we are going to start to see people maybe not artificially inflate catchers, but over the years just start to pay more and more for them, considering how deep the pool is?
Well, I think absolutely, because I think it's kind of like a shortstop light. We've known how many amazing elite players there are at shortstop. The elite ones are gone by the fourth or fifth round. Right? Yeah. There's a lot of them, but they're gone. It's very top heavy. Yeah, the catcher pool is deeper than it's ever been. But in a 15-team league, do you want Luis Torrens in your lineup right now? He's a top 30 catcher over the past 30 days. Yeah. Is that who we want? No, we want these top guys. So that is going to drive the price up on the, you know, the top 15 or 20 catchers, I believe.
Yeah, we had 9 of them go inside of the top 100 picks last year, and they've pretty much all paid off, ironically, except for the number one guy, Cal Raleigh, who was struggling and then got hurt. Augustine Ramirez got sent out. His stat line wasn't terrible. They just, you know, I think they wanted to get him some reps in the minor leagues and maybe slowly work him over to first base. And then Sal Perez is kind of at the end here, but you do have the up-and-coming young talent. So I think catcher, I think that comparison to shortstop is really key. You are going to see, it was kind of a taboo position for so many years, but I think catcher at this point is just another regular position with the same level of depth nearly that you're going to see from the shortstops and the first bases. So I think that the landscape has entirely changed. And I think that to this point of the season, that is one of the bigger storylines for me, just how deep catcher is and how I think that will potentially impact over the next couple of seasons. Let's talk about some rookies, Kev, because this has been the year of the rookie, and it was forecasted by some people. I think Rob Silver was the loudest of the bunch, saying that the rookies are just too cheap this year. And normally, you know, I think in the NFBC world, especially, people are usually looking to drive the price up for the hot new toy in the player pool. but that wasn't really the case so much this season. There were a couple of more expensive rookies, but they were all fairly affordable. On the hitting side, we'll start there. Munetaka Murakami, Kevin McGonigal, J.J. Weatherholt, Sal Stewart, Connor Griffin, Samuel Basayo, Chase DeLauder, Kazuma Okamoto to some extent. I know the batting average hasn't been great, but he's on a 30 home run pace. Yep. What have you thought so far, Kev, of this rookie crop? I don't really know if this is a trend that we're going to see continue over the next few years, if rookies are just going to continue to be the good values, or are we just in a really good year for rookies? And also following up on the Bobby Witts and the Julios and the Corbin Carrolls who came out of the gates running. What do you think is the impact of what we've seen going forward, just based on how good these rookies have been right away to start their careers?
I think it's a little bit of all of what you brought up. The draft has changed. We have less minor leagues available, less minor league teams. Some of these college guys being drafted, we have to think of some of these colleges, these guys are being drafted from until just a couple of years ago. And there's probably still some out there that some of these universities have more modern research and development. And especially when you get into analytics, and some MLB teams do. So especially some of these college guys coming out and them hitting the ground running, that makes perfect sense to me. Now, some of these guys you brought up are 19 years old. That doesn't have anything to do with them, but I do think it's similar. It's filtering down to high schools, and especially on an individual player level. The players that want to dive into this type of stuff with the private hitting and pitching labs out there, some of these kids are coming out of high school more developed than what guys would have been after being in the minor leagues for 3 or 4 years, 20 years ago.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've seen a lot with the Angels in particular. It seems like the last few draft classes, they've called that guy up that same year or early up in the following year. But yeah, a lot of these guys, Connor Griffin was a 2024 draft pick. And you're seeing a lot of that, these 19, 20, 21-year-olds coming up and just dominating to start their careers. Now, there's also the Murakamis and the Okamotos, like I mentioned, and those are slightly different cases. But Kevin McGonigal is already such a polished hitter. J.J. Weatherholt is an auto. I think they're both all-stars. McGonigal and Weatherholt are both going to be all-stars. Sal Stewart, with the potential for first, second, and third base eligibility with the ballpark, that is probably the best power park in the majors, or top three, and the speed component, I think Sal Stewart's going to be like a second round pick next year. Is that crazy to say? Potentially, maybe, Kev, if he gets hot and goes 30-30 or something along those lines, which isn't out of the realm of possibility, could Sal Stewart maybe even be a first round pick in 2027, assuming we have baseball in 2027?
Well, yeah, good point. But I think we're at the point with most of these guys where we have to see their adjustment now. McGonigal not performing nearly as well in May as he did in April. Weatherholt, Stewart, Griffin, Basalo's still been amazing. He's the outlier. Chase DeLauder, not nearly as good in May as he was in April. So they need to make their adjustment, or they're not going to hit what their season-long pace is at right now, because they're performing much worse the second month of the season than the first month. The ones that do make that adjustment, yeah, these are the guys we will see moving up draft boards next season. The ones that struggle a little bit, they may still be those values we're talking about, because a lot of us still are very reluctant to draft even players that young coming back in their second season, especially if they have some of these struggles to point at for the reason they're going to do that. But the ones that make the adjustments will be the ones I'm interested in next season. I think in general, because so many of these guys were so good to start the season and their overall numbers at this point are still so good, I think they're going to be overdrafted next year.
I think that is probably correct. Yeah. I mean, if you look at not just the guys that we've seen to this point having success, but also the incoming crop that we'll have. And, you know, I'm not the biggest prospect guy, but I think the names that are on the top of the prospect list that are likely to be debuting either late this year, early next year, Jesus Mate, Leo DeVries, Walker Jenkins, there's Aiden Miller, you know, Ethan Holliday is probably still a couple of years away. But I think just based on the early success that we've seen from this crop and even over the last couple of years, I think there's been a pretty high success rate for these prospects getting called up, especially the top names, the ones that we're drafting for fantasy purposes. I feel like people could potentially start to just overrate them and say, well, the most recent crop of prospects has been hitting, so therefore I am going to jump this guy up two or three rounds in ADP. And I mean, this year that strategy would have worked for you. If you had jumped Sal Stewart a couple rounds and you jumped McGonagall and you jumped Murakami, you're probably in first place. But I don't know how sticky that trend is necessarily. I think what you said earlier is a great point, that the college level developments are so far advanced, especially ahead of where they were before, that players are just debuting much more polished versions of themselves than they used to be. But I still think that it's potentially going to be a bit of a cautionary tale in a couple of years when we look back on 2026 and how rookies dominated, especially on the offensive side. We haven't even got to the pitching side yet, but these offensive standouts could potentially make the market overreact a little bit next season, Kev. Let's go to the pitching side, because they are no slouches in their own right. Parker Messick, Peyton Tolley, Treya Savage, who is still a rookie despite everything that we saw from him last year, pitching at literally every level of baseball, including the World Series. Nolan McLean, who has had a couple of clunkers recently but is still excellent. Connelly Early, Foster Griffin. It's been outstanding on the pitching side. Let's talk about a couple of your favorites, Kev. Is there one of these pitchers, or maybe a couple of them, that you would like to discuss that have really caught your attention so far this season?
Well, it's hard not to just absolutely be amazed by what Jacob Mizorowski's doing, especially if you watch him pitch and you're not just looking at box scores. He is so much fun to watch. And I'm a little biased. He was somebody I was drafting fairly often in draft season. So that does add to my excitement. On the other end of the spectrum, I am so upset with myself with not having more Parker Messick, because I really liked what he was doing earlier and I waited too long, didn't get enough of him. So I'm a little upset at that, but yeah, these guys have, I think with the pitching, it's similar. I think it's, you know, we there's all kinds of the pitching labs out there, and so many of these guys are starting to attend them very, very young. So they're far more polished in terms of arm slot and tunneling and that type of thing. They're much more polished in those types of things, sequencing, before they even get to the minor leagues. And I think that's attributing to a lot of this.
Yeah, Parker Messick is also a guy that I kind of kicked myself on. It was 7 starts last year where he had a 2.72 ERA. He had a 19% strikeout to walk rate. The thing that was a little bit worrisome maybe was the 1.31 whip that he had, but I don't know why I didn't draft more of him. He was totally right. Affordable. Looking back on it now, it seems obvious that this was going to happen, especially for a team like Cleveland that over the last decade or so has been one of the leading pitching organizations around the league, I would say. Still just 25 years old, lefty. There's a lot to like with Parker Messick, and through his 12 starts to begin the season, a 2.21 ERA, a 1.07 whip. He's got the strikeout rate over 27%, just a 34% hard hit rate against. There's a lot to like. There's a lot to like with Parker Messick and this whole crop of rookie pitchers. I mean, again, if you'd constructed your team entirely out of rookies this season, literally every pick as a rookie, I think in most leagues you'd probably be number one if you comprise your team of the guys that we've mentioned here: Murakami, McGonagall, Weatherholt, Yasavage, Peyton Tolley, Parker Messick. You'd be doing very, very well for yourself. Now, you mentioned Jacob Mizorowski, who is having a phenomenal season. Depending on which player rater you look at, he might be the number one player. He's the number one pitcher on a lot of different sites. But there's a kind of a trend here, and it's something that goes against, you know, conventional thinking. A lot of pitchers who came into the year perceived as massive injury risks have performed very, very well. And now I say this, we're only about a third of the way through the season, and there are still chances that these guys do get hurt. But Jacob Mizorowski, Chase Burns, Zach Wheeler, Garrett Cole, the aforementioned Treya Savage, Carlos Rodon, Jared Jones. It's still very early, but very good signs we've seen from him. Kev, are we just really bad at evaluating and predicting injuries, or is this a huge outlier that these guys have all just happened to stay healthy, come back and look amazing the way that Wheeler and Cole have? Is this just really fluky stuff? Should we still be as worried about pitching injuries as usual, or should we maybe lean into the fact that they're too hard to predict?
Yes. I think it's all of that. I really do. I think, yes, we are bad at predicting injuries. I mean, it comes down to, you know, to our extent of predicting injuries. As far as what we know, the number one predictor of future injury is a past injury.
Yeah.
That's not a lot to go on. Every single one of these guys has been on the IL at some point in their career, right? For something. So what extent of injury does it matter? I think there needs to be more research done on this, but yeah, we're absolutely terrible at it. I think it goes both ways. You know, we see Zach Wheeler coming out and with a, you know, he's got a ERA around 2 and a WHIP under 1, and he looks like Zach Wheeler. Crazy that you could draft him where you did if you'd have known he was going to come back when he did. As healthy as he's been, he'd have been drafted way earlier. So it goes in both directions. We see guys like we thought, you know, another common, I think, belief amongst a lot of us is if we see a guy at the end of last season healthy, had a normal offseason, we're not as worried about that previous injury. That was a guy like Cole Reagans that obviously has been really banged up. So it goes both ways. So to that extent, I think, yes, the number one issue here is we are bad. We don't know which guys are going to be injured, whether it's guys we perceive to be injury risks or guys we perceive to be low risk, healthy guys. We're wrong.
Yeah. I mean, a couple of years ago, before Cole had his big surgery and missed the couple of years there, a year and a half, whatever it was, he was perceived as about the safest guy there is. Coming into the year, Max Fried had, I mean, he has had some problems. But Max Fried punches tickets every year on 180, 200 innings, and he's on the shelf. So it is very hard to predict. But all along those lines, Jacob Mizorowski, I think, if we were going to do a draft of who is the riskiest pitcher in all of baseball from an injury standpoint, I think it would be Jacob Mizorowski at the top. He is
just based on throwing that hard, and yeah, and he looks a whole lot like Chris Sale did, right, coming up, and we had those worries, and Chris Sale defied our worries for a long, long time. They finally did catch up with him. It was kind of fluky things, not really his arm like we thought it would be, but yeah. So I mean, just looking at the guy, we see an injury risk.
Yeah, with Chris Sale, when he got hurt, it was more that he would like punch a cooler or a TV or something that. It was usually something kind of out of left field. But Jacob Mizorowski, let's speak to those who are in trading leagues just for a second, Kev. And the fact that he does throw maybe harder than anybody in history, and he uses this fastball 63% of the time. It's really just fastball, fastball, fastball. I believe in his most recent start, it was 21 consecutive fastballs to start the game that were all over 100 miles an hour. It is incredibly impressive, but it also does feel very, very risky. If you are in a league where you can make trades and you can get yourself a king's ransom for Mizorowski, with the caveat that we're very bad at predicting this stuff, do you think it's prudent to at least explore trading him and trying to fill some other needs just based on the fact that everybody's always one pitch away, but when you throw that hard, maybe you're a half a pitch away? So would you try and trade him if you had him?
That's tough. It always obviously depends on what your goal is for your team this season. That's always going to be taken into account. I think if you are competing, it's largely due to him, and you need to ride it out. If I was rebuilding, would you rather have Jacob Mizorowski, or even knowing that there may be an injury coming and you'd be holding him through that? I think there could be a scenario, and of course it depends on the return. Absolutely. I would shoot for the moon though, and I wouldn't accept when people start countering less. No, I'm standing firm. This is what he costs. Otherwise, I'm holding on to him, because it's not like this is an older guy we're trying to get rid of. And as we just discussed, we're very bad at predicting these injuries. So I think it would have to be an amazing return.
Yeah, I think, you know, in a redraft league, I would view it a lot differently than I would in a dynasty league. And if I have him in a dynasty or a keeper format where he'd obviously be one of your keepers, you have to assume at some point that you are going to miss an 18-month period of time with him. Factor that in. He's still very young, and maybe it happens next season. Maybe it happens when he's 28 years old. But at some point, almost every pitcher eventually needs a Tommy John surgery. And we just see, you know, Jose Barrios is going to need a Tommy John surgery, and he throws 89 miles an hour. So it can happen to anybody. Yeah. And it's probably a little bit more likely with Mizorowski. So what I would say, I've got a ton of questions about it recently. Kick the tires and just see what somebody would be willing to offer you. And maybe somebody is just over the moon. Maybe somebody does live in the state of Wisconsin and they're willing to give you Chris Sanchez and somebody else for him, or you maybe get a crazy offer, especially if you are playing in a more home league setting on Yahoo. If you're playing on CBS or ESPN, kick the tires and see, because there is a big risk. But as I've said many, many times now, we're very bad at predicting this stuff. He could go another 8 years before anything ever happens to him, or maybe he doesn't. It's very hard to know for sure. But what we do know for sure is that Jacob Mizorowski is the number one pitcher to this point of the season, $5 ahead of the number two pitcher, Cam Schlittler, who did have a bit of a stinker yesterday, but still sitting with a 189 ERA himself. And Mizorowski is so much farther ahead in the player rater. Already 108 strikeouts, just an unbelievable season.
Yeah, that's crazy. And going forward, I think there are two main targets I will have for some of these guys that we do think may be an injury risk. The elite guys like Zach Wheeler, like Jacob DeGrom last season, guys that have been elite. I think we should probably bump them up our draft board a little bit if we think they're coming into the season or very shortly after the beginning of the season will be healthy. Now that does bite you. I held the two seasons ago when we kept hearing Brandon Woodruff would be back next week all season long, and he never came back. That happens, and that's the worry. But I think in general, more times than not, the elite guys will overperform where they're being drafted. And then the guys being drafted really, really late, go ahead and take that risk. Spencer Arrighetti, perfect example. He was being drafted really, really late, and his performance last season, as Nick Pollock was shouting at the beginning of draft season, he was really good when he was healthy. And so there's an example there. I think like Zach Wheeler and the Spencer Arrighettis are the two types of guys I think were probably underdrafted.
I completely agree. And like you said, sometimes it's going to work out, sometimes it isn't, but that's kind of the nature of the beast with fantasy.
Absolutely.
You're taking your shots, right?
It's just like when fans arguing about a baseball game, a play in a baseball game, same thing with draft position, same thing with fab bids. When what was chosen doesn't work, it's easy to assume if we had chosen the alternative, it would have worked. And that's not the case, right? We're playing at a game where we're going to fail more times than not, regardless of the decision we make.
Well said. Yeah, it is very hard. And, you know, as somebody who's played all four major sports from the fantasy side of things, baseball is by far the hardest. It is not even close, folks. So it is very tough, but you got to stick with it, right? You're going to drop half of your team probably. That's why you stay active on the waiver wire. And if you're able to, in the trade streets as well, and kicking those tires on potentially selling high. Not necessarily your classic sell high, he's going to go bad, but explore the trade market on those guys who've been performing exceptionally well. But kudos to you if you did draft Jacob Mizorowski and Chase Burns, because what I can promise you is that they'll never be available past pick 100 again. So good job on that one. Let's talk about the other side of the spectrum here and talk about some big name disappointments. There have been a ton of them who have been off to very slow starts. I'll give a few names here and then we can talk about maybe a couple of your favorites or least favorites from the group, Kev. Kyle Tucker, the first year of the big contract for the Dodgers, things have not gone well for him at all. Fernando Tatis finally hit his first home run of the season the other day, I think on his 62nd game of the season, which is incredible that Fernando Tatis acquired second base eligibility before he hit a homer, I think you would have won a lot of money if you bet on that before the season that that would have taken place. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. up here in Toronto. Now, he does have a 400 on base rate, so I think some people would say he's still performing well, but only three homers to this point of the season is not what anybody thought after his historic playoff run. Jazz Chisholm, who has been a bit of a mixed bag, I think he's been a little bit better recently, but still not really paying off where you drafted him. And then Trey Turner and Manny Machado, and also Brent Rooker, are the rest of the kind of big name bats here that have not at all paid off their draft costs. So out of this group of disappointing, roughly top 50 hitters, Kev, any in particular that stand out that you'd like to break down here?
You know, some of these guys we've seen this from before, right? Trey Turner, we've seen him have some ups and downs throughout his career. I expect him to come out of it. Manny Machado, same. Brent Rooker to a lesser extent, but he's been so good over the past three seasons. I expect him to come out of it. Some of the guys that depend on athleticism for their to really bring their talent forward, like Jazz Chisholm, like Fernando Tatis Jr. These are the guys that worry me, right? They get into patterns. I think Fernando Tatis is suffering the same issues that we saw with Bo Bichette. He just stopped pulling the ball in the air. Never does anymore. That all of a sudden, that two seasons ago, went to zero for Bichette. And it hasn't come back. And that's what we're seeing right now with Tatis. So I'm worried about these guys that are very athletic and stop pulling the ball in the air for whatever reason. And so I haven't, in spite of the improved play we saw from Bo Bichette last year, I was not in on him at all this season. He started out pretty well and now has fallen off. And guys like Tatis, when we're seeing this, I will not be back in on him next season unless by the end of this season we start seeing him pull the ball in the air. It's not an easy thing to bring back.
Yeah, I think that is a huge key. He's also just really boosted the ground ball rate as well, which is they're kind of tied hand in hand. But he'd always been about 46, 47% ground ball rate. It's up to 53. Now, he's still hitting the ball fairly hard. It's a 10% barrel. It's a 51% hard hit rate. But his average exit velocity at 90 is the lowest we've seen since 2019. And the barrel rate at 10%, while it's still an above average number, is his worst number that we've ever seen. I wonder if Tatis will ever get back to those early career marks. Those first three seasons, he was averaging a 153 WRC plus per year. He was an elite hitter. He had 42 homers in 130 games. Yeah. He's also hitting for average and stealing bases for you. 2021 Tatis is the best version of him we've seen. And then after that, we have the PED suspension. We have, I believe, two shoulder surgeries. He's been about a 130 WRC plus since, maybe even a little bit lower. And this year he's at 98. Is it safe to say that we'll never see that early version of Tatis again, Kev? If you're holding him in Dynasty, would you expect that that's a realistic outcome in the next 3 years, that Tatis is again an MVP-level player?
I would not be holding out hope for that, no.
No. I think that's probably where I am at as well. He's still so young, still 27 years old, but you know, you have to wonder how much that shoulder injury, or the shoulder injuries, because there was a couple, and there was a famous quote where somebody asked him a few years ago, how are you feeling after the motorcycle accident? And he responded with, which motorcycle accident?
Right.
So there's been a lot of stuff that's happened with Fernando Tatis. So a little bit worrisome there, especially from the power perspective. I think eventually he figures it out, just based on the fact that even last year and the year before and the year before that, post-surgery, he was still a 20 to 25 homer guy. But this year, I mean, I was talking with Justin Mason a few weeks ago about will he get to 20, and at that point I said he'll get to 20, and at this point in time I don't feel as confident in that assertion that he will in fact get you the 20 homers. Now I am contractually obligated to talk about at least a couple of Blue Jays on every show that I am on, so I'll mention Vladimir Guerrero Jr. just to get your thoughts here. Now, he has five stolen bases, which is nice, but the fact that the stolen base total is higher than the homer total is a little bit ridiculous. But he's still doing a lot of things very well as a hitter. He's hitting .297. He has a .390 on base rate. He has walked more than he has struck out, but the barrel rate has cratered to below 7%. The average exit velocity, again, for him, it's the same as Tatis, the lowest since 2019. While he is still a good contact hitter and he'll hit for average, the power is gone, and I'm not sure if and when it'll come back. Kev, what do you think of Vladdy this season?
Yeah, and we've seen this from Vlad before as well, when we don't get the home run numbers from him that we typically expect. But he's just not barreling up the ball, right? As you said, it's still he's 36th percentile according to Baseball Savant right now in barrel percentage. 36th percentile. He's never, well, since 2020, he hasn't been below 70th percentile, and he is in almost the lower third of major leagues in that aspect. So obviously other correlating numbers are going to look at that as well. His launch angle, sweet spot, way, way down, lower than average. And all of this, he's chasing like he did in 22 and 23. 2024 and 2025, he really improved his chase rate, and it's down to 40th percentile again here for Major League Baseball on this season. So we've seen this from Vlad in the past. I think he bounces back. I don't think we ever see 48 home runs again, but I do think we see 30 at some, maybe even this season. He can go on that kind of a run. Yeah, I'm not too worried about Vlad.
So he'll
figure it out.
What I was going to ask you there is, who would you take rest of season between Vlad and Tatis? But it sounds like you would be more on the Vladdy side than the Tatis side.
Oh, 100% without any question. I don't even have to think about it.
Okay. So you're really fully out on Tatis here. So where would you put him if we were drafting, let's say, for rest of season or for next season? Is Tatis a third rounder to you, a fourth, maybe even lower based on what I'm hearing here, Kev? You seem pretty out.
Let me look here real quick. This is great. Let's see here.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
No, I love this question. I just want to take a quick look. Yeah, he'd be outside fourth round for me.
I think, without having done a deep dive myself, I think that's probably correct. Yeah, without the power. And you also got to remember, he has 18 RBI, 22 runs. I mean, the 14 steals are nice, but that's kind of all you've been getting from Tatis. So I think fourth or fifth round is probably where I'd be at as well. Let's go and switch gears to the pitching side, because there's also been some early round disappointments, not to the same degree. The early round pitchers who haven't panned out are more so based upon injuries, especially at the very top there with Crochet and with Skubal. Got another setback for Crochet yesterday or today, we heard about. So things are not looking good for him. It might just be a lost year. But the early pitchers, by and large, if you took Sanchez, if you took Yamamoto, if you took Brian Wu, you've been pretty happy. Logan Gilbert hasn't been amazing, but he's been pretty solid. But on the disappointing side, I was a big Cole Reagans fan. Now, he got hurt, but before he got hurt, things weren't great. And the same can be said for guys like Logan Webb and Yuri Perez, dealt with injuries, but even before the injuries, things weren't great. Kyle Bradish has turned things around recently, but it was a devastating start for the ratios. I think it was a 7 ERA and a 180 whip through his first few starts. Sandy Alcantara, things have not been great for him. Trevor Rogers has been horrible. And, I mean, Jesus Luzardo has done this thing where he gives you a couple of good starts, and then he'll get blown up by a team like Colorado. So which pitchers, or maybe even just a singular name here, Kev, would you like to break down among the pitching disappointments?
Oh, I drafted all these guys, every one of them, and multiple shares of all of these guys. These all hurt. I would say I have the least of Sandy Alcantara. A lot of Cole Reagans and Yuri Perez. And yes, it's been the injuries recently, like you've said, but both of them were struggling a bit when pitching, and it's been command with both of them. And that's typically, it's especially with Tommy John, which is not what we're dealing with at the moment anyway, with either of these guys. But I would say any injury when pitchers are coming back, command's the last thing to come back. So I'm worried about these guys. Yes, I'm holding them in leagues, but I'm worried about their performance when they come back as well. And with a guy like Cole Reagans, it's yeah, he walks some guys, but it's not necessarily just the walks. It's that he does go deep into counts with a lot of hitters. So he has high pitch counts, even if he's not walking guys, which leads him to not going as deep into games as we'd like to see. And him and Yuri Perez, I think that's going to be an issue for both of them coming back.
They were two of my most drafted pitchers this year. Looking at Reagan's is 2025, albeit an abbreviated 61 innings, but he led all pitchers in strikeout to walk rate. I believe he had the best or the second best Sierra, which was at 252. You know, despite the fact that it was a 4.67 ERA, this felt like a great bounce back opportunity, and things have just been awful for him. He's getting barreled up. It's nearly 16% of the time. The walk rate was at 15%. I'm a little bit worried about Reagan's because 2024 is starting to look a little bit more like an outlier than the norm. And I'm a full on believer in the talent, but at some point, you got to stay healthy and you got to put the seasons together. And I wonder, Kev, heading into next year when he'll be 29, what the price will even look like. Will people be paying a top 100 price on Cole Reagan's anymore? I doubt it at this point.
Not unless we see a really good second half out of him.
Yeah. And I also wanted to discuss Jesus Luzardo because this feels like more than just a fluky thing where, oh, he had a bad start and it happens. When Jesus Luzardo gets blown up, it is biblical. It is eight runs, nine earned runs. It is always, if maybe this a little bit anecdotal, but honestly, I don't even think it is looking at the game log, because when he gets blown up, you are looking at some really, really horrific starts. Going back to 2025, he obviously had the 12 earned run start against Milwaukee, eight earned runs against my Blue Jays, and then there was another start with six, another start with five, a bunch of fours across the board. And then you look at this season, he's already got four starts with at least five earned runs, including eight against the Cubs and six against the Rangers. And then he'll follow it up with a bunch of good starts, but the overall numbers equal out to about a four ERA, and that's what they were at last season. So is Jesus Luzardo maybe a little bit overrated, Kev? Did the amount of outs that he gets via the strikeout lead us to maybe overrate Jesus Luzardo?
I think I fell into that. Yes, that's part of what I have come to realize. And also, but at the same time, unfortunately, he's giving us a higher whip than he typically does. Whip was something I was paying really close attention to during draft season. Yes, or no, I should say probably. I don't think we'll see the 1.04 whip out of Luzardo that we saw back in 2022. But he'd been a 1.2 to 1.25 guy, which isn't great. But as you were saying, the strikeouts, I felt that was a nice trade. Once you hit that 1.3 whip mark, that destroys us. I don't remember the exact numbers, but at some point last season, Jeff Zimmerman put a question out on Twitter, what equivalent ERA, what ERA is equivalent to 1.30 whip in your lineup? And I believe it was over five. A 1.30 whip is so much worse than we perceive it to be. And that's what's killing Luzardo for us this season.
Yeah, that I do remember that. And I believe the genesis of that article was Yusei Kikuchi, because Yusei Kikuchi had a 1.6 whip or something, but it was a 3.45 ERA. But yeah, it really, really does negate all the other goodness that you're going to get. Even for a guy who doesn't allow a ton of homers, he has really good command, lots of strikeouts. It's just when he gets blown up, he gets blown up so that everybody can hear it. And it just ruins your ratios for quite a while. Because even though the last month has been really, really good for him, to your point, I mean, it's a 4.3 ERA still, and it's a 1.30 whip. And if he has another blow up, then those will just reset back into the fives. And, you know, this is not very analytical of me, but he's kind of due for a blow up. Jesus Luzardo has gone four starts without one, and that's kind of been about the limit for him over the last couple of seasons. So I'm hoping things stay on the right path for him, but I don't think, regardless of what we see the rest of the way, I don't think I'll be personally ranking him, drafting him as an ace next season. I think that he is a really good, serviceable 2 to 3, but if he gets hot and has a great couple months here and people are pushing him up as an ace, then they can draft him as their ace. I will not be one of the people doing that. Final topic here, and it's kind of a two-parter here, is the resurgence of two teams that were not terribly great last season, and they have two best teams in baseball.
baseball at this point. We'll start with the Tampa Bay Rays, who is the American League. They are 36 and 20. Phenomenal. It's really been my game. Pitching side, Nick Martinez came into yesterday with an ERA in the ones. He hadn't had a start where he had allowed more than two earned runs all season. He finally had a bad one yesterday, but he's still been great. Shane McClanahan has looked like his usual great self in his return, which I was not expecting. I thought that he would struggle out of the gate, and he hasn't. Drew Rasmussen's doing his usual thing, which is phenomenal stuff, as it always is. And then Brian Baker out of left field has become one of the best closers in all of baseball and one of the best waiver wire pickups of the season, potentially even a top two or three waiver wire pickup of the season. What are your thoughts on the Rays as a whole? We have seen this over the course of the last 20 or 25 years. They're always kicking around. They're never fully out of it. Is this a team that you think is a legitimate contender? Are you afraid to stream your pitchers against them? Are you trying to get a piece of their lineup potentially just to pick up on what we've seen to this point? What does your evaluation tell you about the Rays? Is this a real great team, or is this just a good couple of months?
Any team that can throw Taylor Walls out there in their hitting lineup on a daily basis and win baseball games is an amazing baseball team. And I'm a Taylor Walls fan. I thought he would hit better than this at the major league level. But yes, it's amazing what they do. I very often with Adam on the wire on a weekly basis when we're talking about a matchup versus Tampa, to your point, I will make the comment, yeah, Tampa's been really good, but I'm not scared of this lineup. And I too late have come to the conclusion I think we should be. They put up a lot of runs, a lot of days. So yeah, I think I came to that realization too late, but finally I have that. Yeah, this is a lineup we should be worried about.
That 2-3-4 is incredible. Yandy Diaz, a couple of weeks ago on a different podcast, I was comparing Yandy Diaz to Vladdy, and the numbers over the last few seasons are almost identical. Vladdy has more homers, but the same OPS, the same WRC plus, very, very similar players. And at this point, I think Yandy Diaz is just a better hitter than Vladimir Guerrero Jr. at this point in time. I'm not saying it'll always be that way, but he's hitting .314. Again, he's over 300. He's got 11 homers. This is a 156 WRC plus and a 924 OPS. Yandy Diaz, I think every year we do this thing where he falls into the 120s, and it was easy to do this year because, oh, they're going back to the trop. I feel like he's one of the most underrated hitters in all of baseball. Is that a fair statement?
100%. After the 22 home runs in 23, we said we'd never see that again. And when he only had 14 in 2024, we said, see. And then last year, we, as you're saying, we attributed the 25 home runs to playing in a minor league ballpark. He'll never do that again. Now he might hit 30. 100%. And even when he's hitting 14 home runs, when he's doing that with a 300 batting average and the playing on an everyday basis, he's been great throughout his career. I think he's always, he typically falls in that range where there is a group of other first basemen as well that I'm kind of interested in. And I seem to always drift to ones that I perceive to have more power. Maybe not anymore.
The only thing that I am a little bit worried about is the fact that he hasn't played the field yet this year and that he is trending towards being utility only. But again, that's just another thing that people will say next year. Oh, he can't draft Yandy Diaz now. He's util only, and he'll fall in the 160 ADP range again. And I'll be drafting him up if that is the case. I'm a big fan. He is a four-category monster at this point, and maybe that's overstating it ever so slightly, but hits 30 homers or 28 homers with 85 runs and 90 RBI, and he's competing for the batting title. I think that he is one of the more undervalued hitters in the sport. Let's go to the senior circuit and take a look at the Atlanta Braves, who have been phenomenal in their own right. 41 and 20 to this point of the season, following a couple of really disappointing years in Atlanta. Drake Baldwin was the number one overall player in fantasy before he went on the IL. Matt Olson and Michael Harris, both with a WRC plus around 140.
Acuna's back, not all the way back to MVP Acuna, but 130 WRC plus. Ozzy Albies had struggled in May, but picking things up over the last couple of weeks. And even guys like Jorge Mateo, Dominic Smith, Mike Yastrzemski been really, really good. The Braves have the third best team ERA as well, despite the fact that they lost Spencer Schwellenbach before the year. They lost Hurston Waldrop. It looked like it was going to be a bit of a disaster for them, but Chris Sale has performed at a Cy Young level. Spencer Strider's back, and same with Acuna, maybe not back to his old self, but looking very strong. And the depth contributions from guys like Bryce Elder and Martin Perez are unbelievable. They've been two of the best pitchers in all of baseball. So what are your thoughts on the Braves? Kind of the same thing with we saw with the Rays. Are they fully back? Is this a legitimate World Series contender? Are they all the way back, Kev?
They sure appear to be. And if Austin Riley would get going, they'd really be dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And guys like Jorge Mateo, giving him quality plate appearances. You know, we've seen him on the base paths in recent years, and not always a great batting average, but he's going out there at the bottom of their order and playing a nice shortstop and better at the plate than what Haesung Kim is giving him. So he's kind of he's keeping that spot, at least versus right-handed pitching. So yeah, and as you said, I think the big one for me on the pitching side is Spencer Strider. Mm. He's not what he was when he broke out, but I think he has performed better than I thought he would this season. And I think that's helped a lot. And you nailed it. Martin Perez, he is one of my favorite pitchers in baseball. I think part of it's I was in Texas the summer that he had his amazing season for the Rangers and had like 19 wins that year. So just getting to see him go out there and continue to do it, you know, some of these teams just really struggle against left-handed pitching, and he takes advantage of that. It's awesome to see. Bryce Elder, as you said, stepping up when needed, and some other guys that were kind of disappointing that we made, Fuentes and some of those guys that we have seen that may be some depth down the stretch. Yeah. And even with the injury to Drake Baldwin, Sandy Leon plays a good defensive catcher, spells him several days anyway. And Baldwin was DH once in a while. So yeah, they're clicking.
It's a really well-run team, and I think over the last couple of years, people started to doubt that a little bit and thought maybe they got a little bit lucky, but seeing Alex Anthopoulos here in Toronto, I was very sad when he moved on, and now he was running the show there. He got a lot of really affordable contracts on the books. They've put good pieces around them, and you get guys like Jorge Mateo that you mentioned. And, you know, if you add up his WRC plus over the last 2 years combined, it's not equal what he has to this point of the season, that 136. He's hitting 305. He's got a 500 slugging percentage. And, you know, I think it is very goofy by and large, but his average exit velocity is up 4 miles an hour. His barrel rate is tripled from 4% to 12, a 47% hard hit rate. Bat speed is up 2 ticks. I mean, he looks really, really legit. And part of that probably does come down to the coaching aspect. And, you know, I had.
Yeah. And Joe, I'm not looking at it right now. You might be, but if I'm remembering correctly, I was looking at that with Mateo not too long ago. And that bat speed increase didn't come with any lengthening of the swing. So he actually is quicker. He didn't just make his swing longer to get to that higher speed. So that's a huge thing for me.
You're correct. Yeah. The swing length is essentially the same as it was last year and the year before.
Yeah. I had seen that recently.
Just really impressive stuff. I don't think that he is all of a sudden a big breakout. He still chases 40% of the time and track record, but it just shows how they can get the most out of these kind of fringier profiles. Mike Yastrzemski was not doing too well earlier in the season, but he's really picked things up. You mentioned Martin Perez. I think there was a DFA earlier in the season of Martin Perez because they wanted to clear the roster spot, knew he would clear
waiver. And he didn't even miss a start.
And he didn't even miss a start. He had a really good start for them, too. Just a gamer in the same way that Jose Quintana has always just been a guy that you're getting a 3.8 ERA out of. Somehow, some way, they are going to give you those good numbers. I do want to finish off with Austin Riley, though, as you alluded to earlier, and I mentioned, you know, everybody on the team seems to be back. Everybody's 120, 130, 140 WRC plus. And then you got Austin Riley, who for the fourth straight season has seen a decline in his WRC plus, in his batting average, every metric that we really care about. The barrel rate is below 10% for the first time ever. 45% hard hit rate is a five-year worst for him, as is his 91.1 mile per hour average exit velocity. So I'm not really sure what's gone on with Austin Riley. He was looking like he was going to be the next in the line of the Machados and the Jose Ramirez's and the Arenados as the next kind of great third baseman. He had three consecutive 30 home run seasons where he was hitting for a good batting average. He looked like a superstar, a second, third round perennial pick. And at this point, I'm not even sure he's a top 200 pick next year. So do you have any idea what has happened to Austin Riley that has caused this fall off to be so dramatic before he's even turned 30, Kev?
It's a little confusing. And, you know, it really looked like when the calendar turned to May that Austin Riley had turned things around. Started getting on base, started getting his hits, started hit five or six home runs in a couple of weeks. Things looked really good. And now he's 0 for the past week. All of a sudden, like the month of May, things were looking really good until we got to the end of the month. And then it all of a sudden has fallen apart again. So I'm not sure what to think, because I really thought he had turned it around there.
I feel like there will be a year in the next couple of years where Austin Riley, he becomes dirt cheap. Maybe it's next year, maybe it's the year after, and then he'll give you a 30 home run season and be back at it. It's hard for me to believe that he is just fully done, considering how good he looked in his mid-20s. Now, some players burn out earlier, but there's nothing that really indicates that he should have been this bad, especially at this age. It's not an aging curve thing. I don't think it's a team thing, because the team around him is very good. I really don't know how to explain it, but there is a part of me that just the gut tells me, you know, channeling Vlad Sedler here at the end, the gut feeling. Yeah. Austin Riley at his. Here on the FDN Fantasy Baseball Podcast, it's been a lot of fun getting to catch up with you. The last time we actually talked on a podcast was an FDN stream.
That's what it was.
It was Dan's OC stream, from what I remember. We were up to six there, but whatever the occasion is, it's always great to catch up with you.
No, Joe, always great talking baseball with you. Thank you so much for having me. This is it's great. And like we alluded to early in the show, things that we discussed that has given me ideas of things that I want to take into consideration the rest of this week and going forward this season and next. So love having these conversations. Adam, Howe, and myself do the On the Wire Fab podcast each. We try to record as late as we can, Friday evening, sometimes even pushing it to Saturday evening if we can, so that we have update information coming out on first thing Sunday morning for everybody for Fab on Sunday evening.
Definitely a must do combo every weekend is you read Vlad's article and then you go ahead and listen to On the Wire, and then you'll be all set for your Fab bids, and you'll win every bid by a dollar, I guarantee you. Make sure
love
you get
it.
Make sure you guys are checking out the pod. Subscribe to the pod if you haven't done so already. We'd really appreciate that. You can check out my work here at FTN on the Waiver Wire article on Fridays, and then you can also check me out on the Fantasy Pros Baseball podcast and on the Sleeper and the Bust with Paul Spohr and Justin Mason. A lot of miscellaneous little things as well. You can catch Kevin and I pretty much everywhere around these parts. But that will do it. Make sure you guys are following over on the Twitters and the Blue Skies. But Kevin Hastings, I am Joe Rico. We'll talk to you next week right here on the FDN Fantasy Baseball Podcast.